Welcome back to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld. I am so happy to have with me today a real expert, a real scholar, a master, Raymond Moody. I know you coined the term life after life. You're probably the foremost authority on near-death experiences and what's really happening, that consciousness survives. And even more than survives, predates the whole human experience. What was the thing that got you convinced that that was true, that life after life?
Where I am now is, I have to say, for reasons I could explain, that I gather that there is life after death because, see, before I went to medical school and became a psychiatrist, I was first a philosophy professor and got a PhD in philosophy. And I think of these things in that sense. And I think it's very important for people to understand at the very basics that when we talk about an idea like life after death, and I am to insert this, not a parapsychologist, by the way. I feel it's life after death in 2025 is still a philosophical question and not yet a verifiable, testable, scientific question. But that doesn't disturb me. How I got into this, Alan, I remember, strangely, it was about 7 or 8 years old. And this is a long story, at that time, the first book I ever checked out of the school library was a book on astronomy. And I had read several books on astronomy already when the man down the street who had a really nice telescope and knew of my interest called me and my dad down there. And for the first time, I looked through it. And now, to contextualize this further, at that time, my favorite author was Lewis Carroll, and I read both of his nonsense books with great gusto. And also Edward Lear, a lot of people don't know about him, but he was contemporary with Lewis Carroll, and he was a British nonsense poet, too.
What was his name? What was his name?
Edward Lear, L-E-A-R.
Okay. Okay.
But my favorite nonsense author at that time, even at the age of 8, was Dr. Seuss. And this was long before, the Cat in the Hat. When that came out, I rushed down there. Oh, what is this? You know, I was into Thidwick. And then after that, mostly into Horton Hears a Who.
I love that book in particular, Horton Hears a Who.
It's about transdimensional communication, Al.
And it's still relevant for people.
Yes,
absolutely. So,
So I was just in love with unintelligible language, nonsense. I could recite all this stuff. And my dad encouraged this kind of. So anyway, knowing that, that one night, that was the background. And that night I looked through that telescope and I saw that vista. And so at that very moment, Alan, I had what is called a transperspicuous experience. And a transperspicuous experience is an aha moment, exclamatory expression. Ah, oh, I see. Or eureka, right? And right. The realization that I had at that moment was that my two major interests came together in that I realized that when I looked through there, the question occurred to me that occurred to you and everybody listening at some point, right? How big is this thing we're in? Right. And so your mind zips out to the wall. But then you think, upon reflection, oh, doesn't there have to be something on the other side of the wall? You say yes. So then you turn to the only other seeming option, which would be it goes on forever and ever. And that's unintelligible too. And at that moment, my major interests came together, see, in the nonsense and the big cosmic question of life after death. Now, that was the, when I was a kid, Alan, religion was for, I had no understanding of it. My dad was a hardened cop, veteran of World War II Pacific Theater, preparing for the invasion of Japan as a medic, right? And was a professional military officer. Well, you know that mindset or temperament, and that's dad. And so when he came back from the war, when I was a year and a half old, he, the way I experienced it was he's very sarcastic and hostile toward religion, not religious people, but religion. And so at that time, that generation didn't talk about feelings. So, it was only later that I kind of figured out, well, what that was all about was that what he had seen in all those Pacific Islands had hardened him, turned him against religion, right? And so I grew up with that, fortunately for me, because I lived in Georgia in a small town, surrounded by these rabid fundamentalist people, and thank God I got out of that. But my interest was astronomy, okay? And honest to goodness, you probably don't remember who Jack Benny was, Alan, but
I
he was
do. I
at,
do know Jack Benny. Yes.
yeah, and Jack, my when I was about, I guess, early 50s, my Aunt Edna took me to a Jack Benny movie. And it was about going up to heaven as an angel, I saw. And I thought of that as just a funny premise. Honest, and then I saw in the cartoons, but honest to God, honest to, this seems impossible to believe, but I never realized until I got to college that any serious person entertained the notion of an afterlife. I thought it was like a premise of a cartoon with the angels and the clouds and the pearly gates. That was my whole exposure. And
Right.
so, and I, well, anyway, but
But no, let me ask you then,
yeah.
are you saying the whole our whole ability to understand whatever the afterlife is, it's not based on any human logic we can relate to, but it's not
Well,
nonsense, it's just no sense.
I say to the opposite,
Oh.
Alan, and I think I could show you this. But when I had the when at the age of 12, I had spontaneously the aha moment that enabled the prepared me to receive the near-death experiences, despite not knowing about the afterlife as something worth investigating. And it was a very precise series of events. Well, you're too young to remember probably Carl Barks, the author of the Donald Duck and Uncle Scrooge Walt
I
Disney
am too
Company.
young to remember that,
Yeah, and I
yes.
have a complete collection, which is now passed on to my through my son to my grandson. We treasure him. And he was, he was a national treasure, as George Lucas called him. And Lucas and Spielberg were both inspired in his work, and by his work in specific movies they did. And so my response to this same guy was, I had already noticed that he was a really good nonsense person, like Carol or Lear. And when I, it's a specific day, I remember exactly where I was, and I was standing by a, what do you call them, a dresser or with a mirror. And what I realized at that moment was, my God, there's different types of nonsense. See, and for and that's very counterintuitive, right? People think of something nonsense as something chaotic, unformed, undefined, unfathomable, ephemeral,
Right.
but in reality, paradoxically, and this is a very important principle for anybody who wants to rationally comprehend the notion of an afterlife, and I can show you why. But the first thing, one of the first steps toward rational comprehension of the afterlife, to realize that the very idea is unintelligible, as A.J. Ayer pointed out, and David Hume hinted at it. The words sound nice. Maybe we have pictures in our mind, but when you get down to a cognitive sense, there's none. It's really, and it's an illusion we have that term makes sense. But go back to 1915 and become a very informed, educated person of 1915, and listen to this sentence. All four of Ethel's grandparents perished and were lost in a shipwreck long before her mother and father were born. And total nonsense, right? Now, in 2025, add the knowledge of the role of DNA and heredity, gene splicing, gene editing, cloning, and you have an intelligible scenario. Okay, it hasn't happened yet, but we can, it's comprehensible. And that is in the process of happening now with the question of life after death.
So
And
you're
that's how
saying.
I was taken. I want to say, though, here, see, to bring this to a point, that is the mental set I had when I heard about near-death experiences. Because immediately what I realized is, and then about 3 years later, in 1965, I met Dr. George Ritchie, heard his experience. He was the first living person I heard it from. And in this process, I realized that when somebody comes near death and they say, I almost died, and I experienced something. There are no words, they say. It's ineffable, as William James called it. That however eloquent, I just can't describe it to you. It's impossible to describe. And then they go on to say that it did not take place in space. Edmund Alexander a few years ago was saying to me, this is not a spatial environment. It's like, and it's not temporal either. And I said, well, if there's no time and space, what are the orienting axes? And he said, love and knowledge. Right? Now,
Wait, so let me try to integrate all that. So
well, I can
this
do
is,
it quickly for you because
oh,
this is the point.
sure. Thank you. I'm glad you're
Now,
here. Thank you.
applying that knowledge to near-death experiences, if somebody says, I had an experience that is impossible to describe, and it did not take place in time or space, and but this is what I happened is I got out of my body, I went through a tunnel, I emerged into a light, I met my deceased relatives, I saw my life in review, I came back to my body and returned to life. That is a travel narrative. Now think about it. If there is no time and no space and no words for it, then the only way you can relate it is through nonsense. And so the near-death experiences, as powerful and transformative and important as they are literally unintelligible. But listen to when Lincoln was president, formal state ceremony, his part required him to mount a horse and to lead a procession away from this scene in a very solemn way. All the people were gathered around. And when Lincoln got up on the horse put its own back hoof up, got it caught in the stirrup, and the horse was dancing around. The people were embarrassed and shocked into silence. Oh, how embarrassing for Mr. Lincoln. Everybody was dejected. And Lincoln just looked down at the horse and he said, well, if you're getting on, I'm getting off. And now think about it for a moment. That is nonsense, right? Isn't it? Isn't it nonsense to say that a horse, but nonetheless, it communicates a very vivid and meaningful message. And that is the same situation we're in with near-death experiences. The only way to comprehend them is to come to terms with that fact. That's the reality.
Wait, let me have that is so much there. So we're it, from our human perspective of living in this illusion of time space, there's no way to really comprehend the aspect of consciousness not contained in time space. It reminds me of what is happening in the telepathy tapes with non-speaking autistic children. Have you heard those tapes?
I
Those
haven't, but I know about the phenomenon. Yeah.
Right. So who are we under the illusion that we live in time space in these bodies? In essence, we're really not here at
Where
all.
I am on that, Alan, is I have never been able to make it to physicalism. I mean, I am a genuine skeptic, not in terms of these ignoramuses who falsely apply the term. Skepticism is the school of philosophy founded by Pyrrho, who went to, the philosopher. And so that is my technique, which is to avoid drawing conclusions because it expands your mind, and also because you see things on the side pathway that everybody else was missing, rushing to the conclusion. Okay, so I have never been able to conclude from my experience of life that there is a objective, so-called physical world. I am not a physicalist. And does that mean I am not interested in science? Well, I am absolutely fascinated by science, and especially astronomy, and have studied it all my life, and physics too. And to me, those principles which can be established with this frame, within this frame of reference, are also within this frame of reference. That to me, I still, when I read Plato's Republic at the age of 18 and the scene of the men in the cave, the people in the cave, I just, yeah, right on. I had figured it out in a different term, but you'd probably had too by that age, right? And so, and I've never been able to convince myself of physicalism. But as David Hume said, that doesn't mean I walk into an open manhole or something. I mean, you learn, you just this place has and Hume, unlike me, was very, very social. He loved dinner parties and stuff, whereas I'm a hermit, right? But there are different ways of taking that, but that I just am a skeptic. I cannot conclude that there is an external physical world. And yeah, there you
But
go.
if you, okay, maybe there is or there isn't. I think, there's some people may think there's a physical world. And because, wasn't it Samuel
Because of
Johnson?
regularities.
Wasn't Samuel Johnson kick a rock and broke his foot and
Yeah, he
said, thus
did. He
I refute,
did.
thus I
Yeah,
refute thee? Yes.
that's
But
right.
I want to go back to your knowledge about you're a Greek scholar and the oracles of the dead that
Oh,
happened.
yeah, Alan,
Ancient
one of
Greek,
my favorite topics.
because actually, I just lost a very close friend, and yet the presence of that person is still very, I feel very much connected to that. So, what is this thing of the other side? I mean, I know there's no way to prove it, but in your, 50 or so years of research, where do consciousness goes, how is it accessible? What's it like there? And are we connected there all the time anyway? I know that's a lot, but answer what you will.
Well, I'll tell you to the where I've come to in my understanding, and that is through a long process of working as a geriatric psychiatrist with elderly distinguished people for a whole year. Constantly they said to me, Ray, and these were very reflective, some of them internationally famous folks, very reflective people, and they said, Raymond, the older I get, the more I have this uncanny impression when I look back on my life that it has been a, then fill in the blank, script, movie, play, drama, novel story or whatever. And so there is a dawning awareness of people that of what I think of as the narrative nature of consciousness. To me, one of the most striking features of consciousness is that it is narrative, it's directed to put together a narrative. And you know, whenever something happens to us, we weave that new event into the continuing life story. So I say this to exaggerate, of course, but you know, life is story in a very big way.
But it's,
Now,
yeah, go ahead. I was just wondering, is afterlife story as well? That's what.
yeah, well, that's what I've come to is, you know, what is it that survives? Plato said the immaterial, immortal soul. And then Hobbes challenged that in 1500s. No, you know, it doesn't even make sense, the notion of an immaterial, immortal substance. And so then John Locke tried to rescue the picture and say, well, this guy, and his idea was our self is our consciousness and our memories. Then the next, you know, 100 years, I mean, David Hume comes along and says, well, when I look inside myself, I don't see anything that's, you know, that's continuing or a substrate. He said it's always just the passing impression of the moment. So he kind of sort of put a crimp on that notion of a self. Now, where I have come onto it, I just think this is story. You know, what consciousness is narrative direction. And some of the really interesting psychiatric difficulties with people that have interested me as a clinician have to do with disturbances and specifically describable disturbances in the narrative function. I mean, I won't go off on this, but my point is that we're set up to be tell stories. And now, a person with a really good sense of historical perspectives, they will look at, and also a keen logical sense will say that, Raymond, what you're saying is that life itself is a story, and what you're doing is you're taking you're comparing life to one of its elements, namely the theater, right? And so I'm saying that life is a big theater or whatever. But now a logical person will point, hey, just a minute here. That's one of Aristotle's, I think, 14 original fallacies he described, is literalizing a metaphor. That what I'm doing is that I'm taking one aspect of the human experience, namely the theater, and projecting it out in the universe as a model of the whole, and that is a logical fallacy. However, I think it happened the other way around. That to put it baldly, the w reason we have theater is that wizened public intellectuals like Aeschylus and Sophocles and Euripides, they were the public edu you know, the public intellectuals of their time. And they were reflective men, obviously. And they had come to the same realization that my patients did. Oh yeah. And so there was this specific event. It was a harvest festival, very traditional. And then and so part of this was that the a chorus would sing the old stories, right? And that was an old tradition. But on this one occasion, for reasons unknown, Thespis stepped forward from the chorus and spoke his own lines, and it created a sensation. Now, what do Greeks do with sensations is, as Aristotle pointed out, they have a contest. You know, we call them now the Olympic Games, and we still have that, right? Because they were this is, you know, like this inner competition that just won't stop. So yeah, let's have a contest. Which, you know, and so which one, who can write the best one of these things? First prize winner, Aeschylus, then Sophocles, then Euripides. Then, after 50 years, the theater's a profession, right? Well, I think that happened because Aeschylus and Sophocles and Euripides just had realized themselves that spectacular property of life. And so they said, hey, we can dig out a flat place here, magnify the people, shorten the time, and create a sensation. And it did, and it still does, see. But
Yeah.
I think
Are you?
that's our relationship in a way to the afterlife.
Well, I understand. I think I understand what you're saying because you're go so deep. But so the narrative is our way of making a logical sense of this nonsense existence, would you say? Because the narrative is just a made up
Yes, that's right.
sequence. Yeah.
That's right. The narrative does something, but the question is exactly why. And you know, it's like I think the big obstacle to rational proof of an afterlife is assumptions that people make who are allegedly trying to investigate it by reason.
Yeah.
And I think the biggest one is scientism. People who are in psychical research or parapsychology, they look at the question of an afterlife as a scientific question to be solved by scientific method. Well, they can't put together a very good criterion because their criterion is the medium knew things that the medium could not possibly have known about my Uncle Willard. And sure, that gives you a really uncanny experience to hear somebody say something about you that they couldn't possibly have known. I experienced it very dramatically in my first year of psychiatry residency when I really loved working in the ER. I would just at night, I would just sit with the patient, listen to the whole stories. One night I went in, 11 patients. I can't do my normal thing. Okay, first patient. Couple in their 50s, worried to death, like a dark gloom over them. What's the problem? Oh, it's our 30-year-old son. You know, he's staying up all night. He is loud. He won't go to sleep. And so 30 years old. Okay, so I had 10 other patients, right? Normally, I would have listened to the whole story. But now, 10 other patients. So, well, has he ever had a psychotic breakdown before? No, they said. Well, 30 is late for a first onset schizophrenic episode, except paranoid schizophrenic, which is more like 35. But anyway, it doesn't sound like schizophrenics. It sounds like energy. And so I immediately, when I said, well, tell me, has he make it been making lots of long distance phone calls? And they said, together, yeah. Well, what about spending lots of money? Yeah, he spent $5,000 last week. Well, what about hypersexual? Oh, his poor girlfriend. And then what about wearing jewelry? Has he started wearing jewelry? Yeah. And then I said, well, what about a big hat? Is he wearing a big hat? And I remember I happened to look right into the woman's eyes at that point. And, you know, and from her point of view, I was saying things about her son that I could not possibly have known. And that creates a very uncanny experience. But to look at it from a realistic point of view, and I have asked a lot of parapsychologically minded folks this very question, Alan, for a lot of times, and in every case so far as I can remember, it leaves them stunned and surprised. And they say, well, yes. But what I point out is to say the medium knew things about my departed uncle, Hampered, that the medium could not possibly know. They say, and that is what strikes them, right? And makes them feel uncanny. But step back for a moment, and I ask, isn't the sentence, the medium's new things about my Uncle Hamford, my departed Uncle Hamford, that the medium couldn't possibly have known. Isn't that a self-contradiction? I said. And they
I
said,
get
yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. But it's anyway, it's people don't think about these things because they are in a rush to get to a conclusion that there is an afterlife. But as a skeptic, I hold back. I realize why you can't draw a conclusion, but I also gather that it is real.
But how did you know about that woman's son? Was that part of a
Oh,
symptomology or?
no, that's just those are the what you call the soft signs of a manic spell. And it's almost like people who have a even a first manic episode, they never heard about it. But what they do is they start making lots of phone calls, staying up at night, spending money, hypersexuality, jewelry, a big hat. And why, I don't know. But you know what happened. So I was just my thought, my process there was to check my intuition that this was probably a manic spell.
Right. Let's go back because you're such a Greek scholar and you have so much wisdom and knowledge about that. But the oracles of the dead, everyone knows about the Delphonic oracles of like maybe future, but how big was that in ancient Greece? And it's obvious that this discussion we're having has been going on for a long, long time. So what did you learn
The
about the
oracles
oracles
of
of
the
the dead?
dead. Alan, I want to say to you and everybody watching that the most incredible, unbelievable, incomprehensible thing that I know, which is easily verified, is that though many people wistfully say, if I only had 5 more minutes, and we all, you know, we talk about it as though it's something it couldn't be, right? But in fact, it's completely easy. The ancient Greeks knew about it as an everyday thing. And there were these institutions which the historians like Herodotus write about, which the dramatists wrote about, and which the philosophers wrote about. These were institutions. There were about five of them sprinkled around the ancient Greek world. The most prominent in the province of Thesprotia, directly below modern day Albania. These places called oracles of the dead were institutions that created an underworld setting, because the Greeks' idea of the underworld was, I mean, life after death was underworld, right? So it made sense to put these things in caves that had been extended or built under. And they had these places, and they were regular features of Greek life for 1,000 years. And people accepted that these places were. But it's interesting, Alan, that they had the same attitudes toward this kind of thing that people did today. There was a certain kind of haughty folks who looked at the oracles of the dead and said, oh, you know, that's just for the trailer trash, and you know, that's just you know, and then the and then there were the people who, you know, took it seriously and so on and investigated it. But either way, these places, you know, you could go to them, and it was kind of a pilgrimage. They were in out of the way places, and you would go through a process during which, unlike mediumship, by the way, I want to insist, this is not like mediumship. Well, the pe people who worked at this institution were known as psychagogues, and their technique was to bring the dead person back for you, and you know, to be there as you to how you showed you how to visualize the dead person and so on, and counseled you before your experience, you know, like to ask you questions about the deceased person or something. And then you would go into a subterranean chamber, I don't know, about 30 or 40 feet long, I reckon, and maybe 15, 12 feet wide, something like that. And what they had in there was an enormous bronze cauldron that was surrounded by a banister. And so the archaeologist who excavated it thought that it was fraud. But subsequently, I talked to him and he immediately accepted my observation because he said, I should have known that. He just said, I hadn't thought about it because he showed me the iconography. But what they would do is that you take a, say, the big cauldron, brass or bronze, polished presumably on the inside, filled with water, and probably a layer of olive. And they still do this in the Middle East today. It's a folk custom. They do it with silver bowls and olive oil by candlelight. And in the Oracle of the Dead, it was the subterranean space was lighted by torchlight because they can see the carbon marks on the wall. And after a 29-day preparation underground, you would go wind through the subterranean cut rock maze. It's got stone maze, and enter into a dramatic doorway into this chamber. And it was there you would go up and you would gaze down into the mirror and you would see your deceased person and communicate with them. Well, I remember when my 18-year-old omniscience reading that, Herodotus song, the Oracle of the Dead, and I remember thinking, I mean, Herodotus is so right at that. Well, surely he had a bad day that day. He was reporting this as real. Well, imagine, an 18-year-old omniscient guy, 2,500 years later, was wrong, right? And that in 1985, I put a bunch of people, parts of the puzzle together from my knowledge of psychiatry and history and the archaeological findings, and I realized that's what they were doing. And so, of course, the way, hey, let's try this. So I set it up. I put a room together with a mirror on the wall and light proof and comfortable recliner in front of it, and the behind it a light, which you can the person could adjust to their. And that creates an environment which creates an optical clear depth. The mirror is above your line of vision, so you don't see any reflections, and there's no objects in the background. So it's like Ed Mitchell, who came to my place and did it. He the astronaut, he was saying, he said, Ray, it's just like being out in space. And what he said was that you would expect that the space would be flat black, right? Like just flat black. But he said, no, it's glistening black. It's like the whole space has a sheen kind of over it. And he said that was, and other people have described that kind of thing. But after preparation, I would guide people through a reminiscence process. What was this person like? What were his. What the things you miss most, what were the irritating, what was the unresolved, a whole, as you would expect, just like grief therapy. And so then you put the person in there, and to I was thinking, Al, that probably it would be about 1 out of 10. These were my initially my graduate students of psychology, some of whom were older and they had already been counselors and so on and were back for further education. And another was a medical doctor friend of mine, an anesthesiologist, is a psychologist, that like people, a sociology professor, folks who were had studied the mind, and so my I just assumed that, well, anybody who does have an experience, I thought 1 out of 10, that what they'll say is, yeah, I saw an image in the mirror, it looked like my grandma, but was it real or was it a figment? I don't know. And so I refrained from going in myself because I wanted to first get a picture of what other people see. So it's my research. And so imagining my surprise when the first they come out of there saying, not, I had a bit, but I saw my grandma, and they interpret it as a real event. And by the way, this process now has been replicated many times, most notably by Arthur Hastings, as you may know, the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology did really two excellent papers on his research on this. He got about 63% on the first attempt. And mine, it was about 50%. So he had a better technique than I. But
So what
in
was
other
your
scripts,
personal experience of that chamber?
well, see, again, I went in there with this know-it-all attitude, and I was kind of unsettled by the fact that my students and colleagues had taken it as a real event. So I just was completely convinced that no, it won't fool me. I mean, how do I get like that? But I mean, it's annoying. But I went in there and I called up my grandmother Waddleton, with whom I had a wonderful relationship. But I only saw her in a flash. It was definitely her. I mean, very not like a mental image. These are eidetic images. This is full 3D in color, moving, alive. It's not like a vague mental picture. This is, and sometimes the person will actually step out of the mirror into the room with the viewer, or other times the viewer will feel they are transported in consciousness through the mirror to the other side where they talk with their dead loved ones. And so that is the reality. There's another method that the Greeks used at the Oracles of the Dead too, which is dream incubation. They had places where you would sleep on the tomb of a dead person that you knew, and they had little sleep chambers over the top of it. The Pythagoreans did that, and because they thought that their friendship was their thing that held them together, and they thought that friendship continued past the death. And so, the way you do it here is because you might get arrested or put in the mental hospital doing it. But anyway, a letter,
If you're seeing
write a
these
letter to
people,
the person.
but you're seeing these people how you assume them to be, because they're probably have evolved and gone on from that. So it's a
I
sort of
have no
projection.
idea. I
Right.
have no idea. But when I'm prepared to see my grandmother Walton, she showed up a little bit flash. It was very realistic. Then, later that day, in the middle of the day, my grandma Moody, with whom I had a difficult relationship, came into the room. What else can I say? To be honest, I mean, I felt her presence. It was kind of like she was indented from physical, what we perceive as physical reality. If you look closely, it's like she had. It was like she was indented, and there was a little inclined plane of light that came out around her and indented her into. But I heard her voice crisp, like through when you hear a really crisp voice and loud and resounding, and it's, she revealed something to me about my childhood that it made sense, and it was a revolution, a revelation. And then she several times, my grandmother in life was not the person who shunned hugs, right? But instinctively, several times during this whatever it was, I instinctively just rushed, leaned forward for a moment and to hug her. But when I did, she would throw up her hands just like this and back off and nod like that. Not before she had been saying words out loud. Now instead, she said, it nods and it happens. I think three. And what? I am left baffled.
I know. Well, I think it's true. I think whatever this thing we call consciousness is being received by the brain, and we are really only using the body as a vehicle of
Yeah, that's right. I think of it
but
like a game piece in Monopoly.
right. But well, then there's then be Then we're still that consciousness before the body, before the life of the body and after. But what is this thing of consciousness, and why does it even exist in the first place? Like, who are we?
I give up, and that's the starting question, you see. And unless you solve that, you can't even know that the physical world exists. Because consciousness is the first presenter, isn't it? It what steps up to the plate and says hello when you're born.
Right. But what do you suspect? I know you don't know because you're a realist in a sense where you just talk about what you know. But if you could hypothesize because of your, over 50 years of research, what sense, if that's a good word to use, would you make of it all or nonsense?
What I think is that number one, people make a major mistake when they think of nonsense as something sublinguistic. If this is ordinary, meaningful language, they think that nonsense is something that doesn't quite make it, that's down here. But once you think it very quickly through, you immediately realize that no, that's just not the truth. The reality is that the ordinary, meaningful language is here, and nonsense is a secondary accrual on meaningful language that has different kinds of effects. And so, and by harnessing that revolution, that revelation, we can actually, I mean, it's already happened, but the more important thing for me to say is that there is, it is, you can see by a path of reasoning that somebody who had a near-death experience, already knowing how to think logically about unintelligible things, when they come back, they will be compelled by a natural link to formulate their experience as an entirely new one that is unlike the near travel narrative version we have now. Okay.
Right.
And so once we get enough of those cases, we can line them up and compare them side by side with cases of near-death experiences that are formulated through the Aristotelian logic lens, which makes them a travel narrative, right?
Right.
But what somebody who understands the logic of nonsense will understand how a travel narrative become nonsense and what to make of that. That when they have a near-death experience, they will be in a different situation because, as an aside, nonsense can be deliberate, a creation of people like Dr. Seuss or Lewis Carroll. It can be involuntary. It's like when the coach says, you guys line up and you guys pair up in threes, right? Well, that's nonsense. But if you correct this, you coach, you say, well, look, coach, pair up means twos, and he can correct it, right? In a good frame of mind. However, a third part though is involuntary nonsense, which people talk when they are sick, okay, and delirious, for example, and or intoxicated with mercury or under severe stress, even with no injury, or all kinds of things that will make people talk nonsense. And what I discovered in medical school, Alan, which is a very significant thing, I think, is that a lot of patients talk nonsense. But when they talk nonsense, the nonsense they talk has identically the same patterns and structure that Dr. Seuss and Lewis Carroll and Edward Lear write in deliberately. So nonsense is nonsense, deliberate or not. Now, where that leads is, with this information, we can accumulate an entirely different account of near-death experiences that don't relate it like Aristotelian logic as a travel narrative, because a person who has one who knows the nonsense logic will say, well, it's unintelligible to put it in the form of a travel narrative for this reason or that reason. And so I must correct it. And so they will tend to reformulate it, right? And that opens what astronomers call parallax. How in the world do we know that it's 4.3 light years out to Alpha Centauri, which everybody knows? But you know, the flock of homing pigeons they sent out there, you know, never came back. So the way they figured it out was, you know, it's we know that it's 186 million miles across the orbit of Earth around the sun, right? And so when the sun is in one position, the angle to Alpha Centauri is very carefully measured. Wait exactly 6 months, measure it again, and you can see there would be a minute difference. Right. And that is parallax. That's now also as a good obsessive compulsive, I've got to go on qualify. Well, you know, there's also the when it gets beyond 10 parsecs, it becomes the Cephalid variables. I mean, there's a lot, but up close that works. Now we can do that same thing now, see, with the afterlife
But are you
by transforming our minds.
by transforming our minds to think in new ways, like what they said about a surrealistic art, you know, the mind looking at Salvador Dali
Yes.
is striving to make sense of this
Yeah.
nonsense, but
Yeah.
because we are being pushed to do that, new neurological connections are being made. Would you say that's
Yeah.
true?
I don't know. See, because see, I'm not a physicalist. It's to me, I was talking, and I know this sounds crazy, Al, but you know, it's like years, 5 years ago, I was talking to Eben Alexander.
Yeah.
And I said, Eben, I think the brain is a projection of consciousness. And he said, right on. See, I mean, it's a big assumption to me to leap from my observations of the human body in you know, anatomy class or, you know, it, or in examining brains and such that those things exist physically any more than the Coke can sitting on my desk here. See, does I mean that's a big inference. I just and it sounds bizarre, maybe, but I can't make the inference to the external physical world, and the brain is a part of the external physical world.
Well,
I
and you know,
don't know what to make all
in a
that.
way, you're the ultimate rationalist because you are only looking at what's evident, and it appears that it's all a
Yeah.
fabrication, in a
Well, it
sense.
could be a fabrication,
Could
see,
be, it
is
could
what
be.
I'm saying.
But I know we don't have that much time left, and you know, your knowledge is so vast. We've only really just got a little piece of. I want to hear more about your history. We'll do more, hopefully, a
Great.
series
Yeah,
with
great, Al.
your knowledge of ancient Greece and why
Yeah.
they are so important as sort of setting the paradigm for
I can
Western.
give you a one sentence summary of that right now.
Oh, okay, do please.
Western reason as we know it originated with these ancient Greek philosophers who were the one of the big questions they were wrestling with is the question of an afterlife. And their rational method included actually experiencing it. They went into oracles of the dead and caves and you know, from their point of view, we're experiencing the other world. So Western reason itself came from oracles of the dead and other, you know, Greek notions about the afterlife.
Right. One more thing I want to ask you is I know you're working on a new book, and hopefully we'll have a conversation about that, but give us a little overview of your recent research because it's so
Yeah.
fascinating what you're doing.
All right, Alan, thank you. Well, I must say that I am on my last legs. Or if not, I am on on the last of my last leg, my next to the last legs, right?
Okay.
And I'm happy about that. I mean, I'm 80 years old and I'm just doing great in many, but it's time for me to put my swan song work together. So I've written my swan song and it will be published soon. And it is a sort of wholly new way of thinking about life after death.
Well, what give us a little hint about that new way
Okay,
because.
soon that is going to be on my website. Lifeafterlife.com, and I will be announcing my seminar called Swan Song. And it's there's a full description in there. It's a hope, I'm sure, like a mind-bending thing for people to experience a whole new way of thinking.
Great. What's your website that people can look at?
It is called www.lifeafterlife.com. And
Thank
you
you.
can get in touch with me through that. I mean, folks can, I have contact information on.
Well, I hope to do like more of these programs with you. I know we have
Great.
Just because I want to go deeper into your investigations, everything you've pulled together, not just to remain a skeptic, which is a great, healthy place to be, but what you've learned through it all. You know, that's we'll
yeah,
do more of that.
Well, I've learned mainly that there is so much to learn that I will never know more than a tiny fraction of it. But that nonetheless, all of it is extremely engrossing and fascinating.
Well, okay. So just to leave us, what was the most engrossing thing about everything you've learned? What was the thing that keeps pulling you?
I've been fascinated since the age of 18 with the history of Greek philosophy. It's just the most amazing, unbelievable, incredible, counterintuitive, addictive story. You know, I've constantly, since the age of 18, I've studied Greek philosophy. If this is Greek philosophy, this is how much I know about. And it's vast, but what there is, oh my God, it's amazing.
Well, we will do more of that for sure, because I always loved the Greeks. I always thought they were the originators of everything we're thinking today
It's
in
true.
the modern world.
It's astonishing.
Thank you, Raymond Moody. I've been talking
Thank
to
you, Alan, and thanks for all the folks watching in, too.
Yes, thank you, everyone, for watching. And we'll be doing more. I've been talking to Raymond, lifeafterlife.com, right? And look for his swan song, which I'm looking forward to, and maybe some classes coming up in the area.